Hey, thank you so much for coming out tonight for this event. One person who's here, as we were standing in line cutting that cake that was too pretty to really cut, she said to me, she said, you know, I feel like I'm among friends. And I get that feeling too. I said, I feel the same way because we all love to read and we're all book readers. I'm Terry Orme. I'm the editor of the Salt Lake Tribune. Not only are we book readers, but we love the Salt Lake Tribune. So that's great. Hey, this evening is part of a year-long celebration that the Tribune is very much a part of. We're celebrating the centennial of the Pulitzer Prizes. And this is a partnership that we're in with Utah Humanities, with Salt Lake City's public radio station, KCPW, and the Logan public radio station, Utah Public Radio. So there are going to be other events like this, and I think the Pulitzers are a worthy thing to support and to celebrate their centennial, and that's what we're doing this year. I would like to thank our panelists for being here and sharing their expertise. I think this is going to be a lot of fun. And I'd really like to thank Catherine Weller and Tony Weller and Weller's Bookworks. Really an institution. You talk about institutions in Salt Lake City. Well, they're certainly an institution in Salt Lake City, and it's great to be here. This space feels really good. I'm going to turn it over to Jennifer Napier-Pierce, who's going to lead this discussion tonight. Thank you, Jennifer.
Thank you, Terry, and thank you everyone for being here celebrating Pulitzer Prize winning literature. Thank you also to Trolley Square for giving us this fantastic space. I love it. I have not been here in a space like this for an event like this, so I'm really thrilled to be here. A couple of thank yous. You may or may not know that the Salt Lake Tribune, as Terry mentioned, has been part of this partnership with KCPW Radio and Utah Public Radio and Utah Humanities Council. As part of our requirement, I'm going to read some language, so bear with me. The event is made possible by a grant to Utah Humanities as part of the Pulitzer Prize's Centennial Campfires Initiative, a joint venture of the Pulitzer Prize's board and the Federation of State Humanities Council in celebration of the 2016 Centennial of the Prizes. The initiative seeks to illuminate the impact of journalism and the humanities on American life today, to imagine their future, and to inspire new generations to consider the values represented by the body of Pulitzer Prize-winning work. For their generous support for the Campfires Initiative, we thank the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, the Ford Foundation, Carnegie Corporation of New York, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Pulitzer Prizes Board, and Columbia University. Okay, let's move on. Let's move on. Tonight is a celebration, so we hope that it feels festive and you are part of this celebration. For the past 100 years, the Pulitzer Prizes have honored the best of the best, the cream of the crop, and tonight we're honoring journalism, because that's what we do, but also Pulitzer Prize-winning fiction and the art of the novel. So each of you came in, you got your very stylish Salt Lake Tribune mug, and stuffed in there a couple of little token gifts, we love them, including a bookmark. And the bookmark has a list of all Pulitzer Prize-winning novels. As we talk tonight, I would encourage you to mark off as many as you have read. We're going to have a little fun with that later. Yes, sir. No. The movie does not count. You might get a little, you know, extra credit, but no, you cannot count the movie. We also want to expose you to a few books that you have not read, or you may not have read. So for the next 30 minutes or so, we are going to do something called Pulitzer Prize speed dating. Basically, each of our distinguished panelists will have 5 minutes, and they're going to sell you on a book that made a difference to them, their favorite Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. And at the end, you will have a chance to question them about their choices. So, our first contestant, Ellen Fagg-Wiest. She is giving the first sales pitch. She is the Tribune's resident intellectual. If you've talked to her, you know what I'm talking about. She writes about theater and books for the Salt Lake Tribune. She earned an MFA from the University of Iowa about 60 years or so after Wallace Stegner studied there. And beyond reading Pulitzer novels, she loves to tell stories about the celebrations when a colleague at a previous newspaper won the Pulitzer for investigative reporting in 2005. She says she was the proud first responder when it came to pouring the champagne. Ellen, you've got 5 minutes. Go.
The novel I've chosen is Wallace Stegner's Angle of Repose, and I would traditionally thank everyone who put on this event, but I don't have enough time. So I want to get started by saying the reason Wallace Stegner needs to win the speed dating contest is that he's the closest thing Utah has got so far as a Pulitzer homeboy. His 1971 classic is a must-read for anyone who considers herself a Westerner. It's a novel inspired by our landscapes, rocks, and mountain views, and all of that is embedded in its language and storytelling. But what sets it apart is the story tucked inside that sweeping epic. The intense focus of a contemporary narrator reconsidering what he knows about his grandmother, Susan Ward, and her marriage. I want to throw down by saying that, of course, this novel's reputation precedes it, which is probably one reason why I avoided reading it for many, many years. Maybe some of you are readers like that as well. You've heard so much praise for Stegner. You know this book is a literary classic. Maybe like me, you are worried that this book might be both dusty and boring. When I first read it, instead, I found myself blown away by reading a great American novel that focused on a strong, complicated woman. She left her refined world in the East to follow her engineering husband to rough Western mining towns. She's caught between her own ambitions and her love for her too honest for his own good husband. And I'm avoiding looking at my husband right now. That a big novel could be crafted out of one marriage was a revelation to me when I first read the book 2 decades ago. As a woman reading the book, I found a place for myself in the great Western story. Returning to the book again this month, I was surprised to find that it was still a page-turner. It's all those conflicting cultural clashes that I found so interesting, as well as the cultural clash between this cranky older narrator, a retired history professor, who is taking notes and for a biography to write about his grandmother. Along the way, he has to reinterpret the story that he had always told himself about his grandparents' marriage. Susan Ward's story is the story of my people, too, the mothers and the grandmothers on both sides of my Western family who faced their own rough times and disappointments while they were raising children along with their butcher and farmer husbands. What Stegner did so well was choose the perfect cranky narrator. Lyman Ward tells us a story that is about settling and disasters, about honesty and disappointments, about working hard and never quite measuring up. It's a story about a wife who loves and still hurts her husband. And it's a story about our part of the country, which is still trying to find our own way. Just a little background. Stegner published the novel in 1971. It was based on an unpublished letters from a real woman who's very much like and different than the character he writes about. It was ignored at first by the New York Times, and then they finally reviewed it about 6 months later, and it went on to win the Pulitzer in 1972. Stegner said about Angle of Repose, "It's perfectly clear that if every writer is born to write one story, then that's my story. I'm arguing here tonight in our speed dating challenge round that this is a story that is our story and my story and your story, and it's a novel that really includes women into the contemporary Western story." And that's what I have to say.
For cranky narrators, woo! Ellen Fagg-Wiest and The Angle of Repose. Okay, our second contestant behind door number two, Becky Jo Gesteland, a professor of English. Put your thinking caps on. and Interim Associate Dean of the Talitha E. Lindquist College of Arts and Humanities at Weber State University. She earned her PhD in American Studies from the University of Utah, where she studied late 19th, early 20th century literature and focused on women's Southwestern autobiographies. Becky Jo, you've got 5 minutes. Go.
I hate to follow. Can you hear me? Hate to follow Wallace Stegner. March, Geraldine Brooks. Joe said sadly, we haven't got father and shall not have him for a long time. She didn't say, perhaps never, but each silently added it, thinking of father far away where the fighting was. Louisa May Alcott, Little Women. Geraldine Brooks is an award-winning author and journalist who was born in Australia, raised on the outskirts of Sydney, and educated at Bethlehem College, Ashfield, and the University of Sydney. She worked for 3 years as a reporter for the Sydney Morning Herald. While there, she won a prestigious scholarship, the Greg Shackleton Australian News Correspondent Scholarship, to the master's program in journalism at Columbia University. Brooks earned her master's degree in 1983 and began work as a correspondent for the Wall Street Journal. As a foreign correspondent, she traveled to the Middle East, among other places of conflict, and in 1990, she won, with her husband, journalist Tony Horowitz, the Overseas Press Club's Hal Boyle Award for Best Newspaper or Wire Service Reporting from Abroad. Pretty awesome. For their coverage of the Gulf War. Brooks's experience as a journalist led to her first book, which some of you may have heard of, Nine Parts of Desire, The Hidden World of Islamic Women, published in 94. The book became an international bestseller and was translated into 17 languages. I'm trying to impress you with her credentials. Her second book, Foreign Correspondence, A Pen Pal's Journey from Down Under to All Over, describes her upbringing in Australia and her development as a journalist through a series of international pen pal letters. This book won the Nita Kibble Literary Award for Women's Writing. Brooks then embarked on a new form of writing, and this is what becomes March, historical fiction. Published in 2001, her first novel, Year of Wonders, became an international bestseller. The novel tells the story of a 1666 plague village based on the actual village of Eam in Derbyshire that quarantined itself in an attempt to control the contagion. We hear the story through a maid turned healer, Anna Firth, who strives to save as many people as possible. Over two-thirds of the villagers died during the plague year. This brings me, long-winded way, to Brooks's March. Published in 2006, Brooks won the Pulitzer Prize for her second novel, which was inspired by Louisa May Alcott's Little Women. The book tells the untold story of Mr. March, the girl's father, who is absent in Alcott's account. In this story, March leaves home of Concord, Massachusetts, to join the Union cause and serve as army chaplain in the Civil War. To develop the character of March, Brooks used the journals and letters of Bronson Alcott, Louisa May's father. Alcott was also a friend of Ralph Waldo Emerson, Henry David Thoreau. Through his account, March's account, we experience the horrors of war, suffer his disillusionment with the cause, and come to the realization that abolition will not happen quickly, if at all. In November 2011, I had the opportunity, this is me now, to interview Brooks at Ogden High School, where she was the invited speaker for the Ogden School Foundation's annual fall author event. As part of her answer to my unfair question, which is your favorite book? She's written a lot of them. She said, it wasn't her, she hemmed and hawed about answering the question, but she said, with March, it was great fun to discover Bronson Alcott and what a fantastic guy he was. How many of you have heard of him? Okay, there you go. Gotta go learn about him. I am embarrassed that I didn't know who he was, but I know I am not alone. He's an underappreciated figure, and his thinking was so progressive for that time, so that was great fun, too. He's a vegetarian before vegetarianism was cool. The Pulitzer Prize website calls the book riveting and elegant as it is meticulously researched. March is an extraordinary novel woven out of the lore of American history. And then concludes, spanning the vibrant intellectual world of Concord and the sensuous antebellum South, March adds adult resonance to Alcott's optimistic children's tale to portray the moral complexity of war and a marriage tested by the demands of extreme idealism. And, this is the kicker, by a dangerous and illicit attraction. Yeah, there's good stuff. A lushly written, wholly original tale steeped in the details of another time, March secures Geraldine Brooks' place as an internationally renowned author of historical fiction. So I encourage you to explore March, to reread Little Women, and to check out some of Brooks' other historical fictions. All of them are truly amazing. So please, give us your vote.
Thank you, thank you. The backstory of Little Women. Thank you very much. Okay, contestant number three, Stephen Trimble. Stephen Trimble read passionately as a kid and started writing as a teenager, and he just kept on writing. He now teaches writing at the University of Utah Honors College, and in four decades, he's published more than 20 books about our relationship with Western landscape. He lives here in Salt Lake City and the Red Rock Country of Torrey. Stephen Trimble, you've got 5 minutes.
So the novels I love best are about people. The novels I love best are filled with characters that I fall in love with, characters that live with us forever, characters we want to name our kids after. And the two characters that occur to me that we really do name our kids after are Atticus Finch in To Kill a Mockingbird and Gus McCrae in Lonesome Dove. And I actually know families that have named their kids Atticus and Gus. Larry McMurtry had to write this book. He grew up in Archer City, Texas. His uncles ran a cattle ranch. His father always dreamed of the great cattle drive north. And when Larry got around to thinking about this story, it was the early 1970s, and he started by writing a screenplay that Peter Bogdanovich was going to direct, and they had it cast. Gus McCrae was going to be played by Jimmy Stewart. And McMurtry admitted to an interviewer that he actually named the character Augustus because he wanted to hear James Stewart say Augustus over and over again. John Wayne was gonna play Captain Call. Eventually that didn't happen, of course, and Henry Fonda was gonna play Jake Spoon. This all fell apart when John Wayne backed out because John Wayne was not quite ready to deal with the end of the Mythic West at that point in his career. Because this is a book that combines the Mythic West with the real West. And it's delightful to read as a story because it has a lot of that myth. But it's not research-based. When one of the young cowboys gets attacked by a nest of water moccasins when they cross a river, it's a riveting scene, but it really couldn't happen. Water moccasins don't even live in that part of Texas. So we have to forgive McMurtry and say, this man is a great storyteller, not a researcher. But what he's done is create this story of these two old Texas rangers riding north. Gus and Call are Don Quixote and Sancho Panza. Captain Call is a Stoic, Captain McCrae, Gus, is an Epicurean. And we go with them north and go through these trials and travails with them for hundreds of pages. And it's riveting enough so that I have to admit, when I read it, I was taking a long trip on interstates across the country, and it's the only time I tried reading a book, a real book, while I drove. I perched it on the steering wheel and was convinced that I could look past it and drive safely. I only did it once. And I finished it, as I remember, in a barbecue joint in Amarillo. So that was appropriate. McMurtry is criticized sometimes for his female characters in here, and he also is criticized for the way he deals with Indians. But the female characters, the women in here, are as complicated as the men. You know, this is not a book that just glorifies cowboys and Indians in the West and women who are living the sporting life. These people have layers. And Gus's great love, Clara Allen, who lives in Ogallala, and the cowboys take turns trying to pronounce that as you read through the book, is a woman of great complexity, played by Angelica Houston in the film that we remember from TV. If you haven't read the book, you may have seen the miniseries, which was the most watched bit of television for years. And Robert Duvall is Gus, and Robert Duvall is Gus. And so he did a wonderful job of capturing the character. The way that Larry McMurtry deals with Indians is as complicated as the way that he deals with every other aspect of this story. He grew up in Texas. He didn't grow up next to Pueblo farmers, and he didn't grow up next to rancherias in California that have been subdued by hundreds of years of Spaniard genocide. He grew up on the Comanche frontier, and in his family there were still stories of Comanche violence. And if any of you have read Empire of the Summer Moon, you know what I'm talking about. The Comanches were fierce. And so the Indians in here kill a lot of white people, and the white people kill a lot of Indian people. But Gus also has a chance to talk about how he feels about Indian people. Gus actually has a chance to talk about everything, because Gus talks on just about every page of this book. Gus is a talker, and he drives Captain Call crazy. And I'm going to read you just a couple of paragraphs to give you the flavor of the repartee. So what the book is really is a cattle drive book. That's the way Larry McMurtry referred to it. And McMurtry is not particularly fond of the book any more than he is the rest of his books. He's one of those writers that just gets up in the morning and writes. And he writes his way through book after book after book. And this book is now 30 years back in his past. So when he talks about it, he doesn't talk about it as anything special. You know, this was the first book about these characters. He ended up writing a trilogy with two prequels to this book. And so he got to know these characters well, and this is absolutely the best of those. I hear a bell. Can I read a quick passage? I'm going to go ahead and read a quick passage.
Time. Okay, quick.
Quick. On the way to San Antonio, they passed two settlements, nothing more than a church house and a few little stores, but settlements anyway, and not 10 miles apart. Now look at that, Augustus said. The darn people are making towns everywhere. It's our fault, you know. It ain't our fault, and it ain't our business either, Call said. People can do what they want.
Thank you.
Yes.
Stephen Trimble. He talks about Western literature. He writes Western literature, and he wears cowboy boots very well. Thank you, sir. Contestant number four. Erica George. Erica George is a professor of law at the University of Utah with an interest in literature. She teaches international human rights law and constitutional law, but incorporates film and literature to give context to the law as it is lived and experienced. I totally want to take your class right now. For the last 13 years, she's been inspired and influenced by the women of the Salty Readers Book Club. Erica George, you have 5 minutes.
Hi, everyone. I'm going to convince you that this is your guy. This is who you want to go with. This is Junot Diaz's The Brief and Wondrous Life of Oscar Wilde. The author was born in Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic, and raised in New York City, very much like Oscar. Who is Oscar? Well, it might appear that Oscar is just another nerdy adolescent boy who's overweight, can't get a date, and all of his friends have bets out on whether or not he'll die before he's a virgin. But he is so much more than that, and you will go many places with Oscar. From Washington Heights in New York, I mean, granted it's not the West, but not far from the west side of Manhattan, to the Dominican Republic. And you'll go across space and time. You maybe begin in his adolescent years in the 1980s, where he's being trained in machismo, and you might go back to where he's from, to the time of his mother, who grew up in the Dominican Republic under history lesson. There are footnotes in Oscar's book, the dictator Trujillo. So for those of you who don't know, you would learn from Oscar. You learn a lot from Oscar. Those of you who missed your mandatory 2 seconds of Dominican history, Trujillo, one of the 20th century's most infamous dictators, ruled the Dominican Republic between 1930 to 1961 with ruthless brutality. I am the human rights lawyer, but let me continue. Outstanding accomplishments include the 1937 genocide against the Haitian and Haitian-Dominican community, one of the longest and most damaging U.S.-backed dictatorships in the Western Hemisphere. So Oscar's also a little political, but through his adolescence, through his coming of age, through his story of coming to America, I think he invites us to learn about ourselves. He tells his story in many different registers, which resonates with me. He tells it in many different languages, from Spanish to Spanglish to English. And he takes us on his coming of age journey and coming into conversation with the relationships that he creates, with the girls he tries to date, hopes to date, with his mom. And ultimately rejects the machismo that he's being taught and learns something much more about the humanity that we all share and the role of women in his lives. So Oscar shares not only his story, but many stories. He's a wonderful raconteur in at least 3 different languages. He's well documented in his history. He's also really funny. And he takes advice. So advice is given to him to lose his glasses, lose the weight. He's got to change if he's ever going to get the girl. And midway through, I don't want to spoil the book for you, he does observe, it's never the changes we want that change everything. For the better, for the worse, for what I invite you to see. He's an aspiring science fiction writer, interested in history, self-described, disastrously overweight ghetto nerd. But I think he invites us to question the kind of identity categories that are possible and that we can create and make for ourselves. So Oscar would be a great time, always interesting, and fabulous, likes food, loves to eat. So that's Oscar.
Thank you, Erica George. Thank you so much. Okay. Behind door number 5, Richard Isaacson. Richard Isaacson is professor emeritus in counseling psychology at Brigham Young University, where he worked for 30 years. He earned a PhD in educational psychology at Cornell University. He was an associate professor of educational psychology at Wichita State University for 9 years. But why he's here tonight? Since 2004, he has collected and read all of the winners of the Pulitzer Prize for fiction. Congratulations. He writes about it on his blog, and if you want to check it out, it's called Pulling Another Pulitzer from the Shelf. And he and his wife, Marnie, remain involved in improving college reading through Isaacson Literacy LLC, a man devoted to reading. Richard Isaacson, 5 minutes.
Thank you. Since I've read all of the Pulitzer novels, it was very hard for me to choose one to talk about, and choosing a favorite would be like choosing my favorite child, and that's hard to do. So I decided to pick a novel that I thought perhaps would be overlooked, because I think it has been overlooked for many years. How many here have ever read His Family by Ernest Poole? I suspected this, so I can tell you anything, and you'll have to believe me unless you read the book. So that's my pitch for His Family by Ernest Poole. But I think the book that won the first prize for fiction from the Pulitzer organization ought to be acknowledged, and that's what Ernest Poole did in 1918 with His Family. The prize wasn't given in 1917, but he had written a book in 1915 called The Harbor, and it was a great success, and many people thought it should get an award, and critics thought that that's why he got the award for His Family in 1918, because The Harbor had been such a good book. Now, a little bit about Ernest Poole. He was born in 1880, graduated from Princeton, born in Chicago. He was a socialist. He and Bernie Sanders would have had many high fives going on right now. And socialism was a trendy thing in 1917. Think about it. It is now. It's become more so, hasn't it? We've thought a little differently, but in 1917, of course, the Russian Revolution had occurred. There was a socialistic government being formed in Russia, and he spent some time in Russia, actually. Ernest Poole also did research for Upton Sinclair. What did he write that you know about? The Jungle. So here is Ernest Poole doing research, helping Upton Sinclair, another socialist. And so there was a lot of social activism at that time. Ernest Poole wrote His Family about a family in New York starting in 1914. The father is named Roger Gale. He's a widower. His wife has been dead for 16 years, and he was left with 3 daughters who are now adults. And the story centers on these 3 women and how a father is trying to relate to them, trying to keep up with what he called this modern approach to life that they were taking, and trying to help them as they sought their roles in society. One of the daughters is a mother. She has five children, married, focusing totally on her family. Another daughter is a principal of a public school in among the tenements in New York City and has thousands of children that she considers her family, and she's a social activist, not only trying to educate these people, but help their families get out of poverty and frankly, stay alive. The youngest daughter is a young socialite who doesn't care at all about society and doesn't care much about her family and finds a rich young man to marry and goes off to Europe to live the high life for a number of years. So in this story, Poole, I think, is trying to put this message forward again about being socially aware, being concerned for others. But I think he also is trying to say something about being a father and having a family. The first time I read this book in 2005, I was struck with the social message. I read it again just this last couple of weeks for this, and it struck me much differently. And I don't know, maybe the 10 years that have passed have caused that, but I read it now as a father. And so I recommend it for that reason. Here's this man, Roger Gale, who's 60 years old. He doesn't have very good health. He's had a business in New York, a news clipping business, and World War I happens, and business goes bad because companies aren't paying for the news clippings anymore. And in the process, he becomes responsible for caring for this married daughter and her five children, along with his school principal daughter, who is living at home and spending all of her money to help the poor, and the other daughter. And so much of the book tells about his struggles, his frustrations, his sacrifices, what a father is willing to do to help his children, help his family. I think it's a beautiful message for that reason, and I would recommend his family to you.
Thank you so much, Richard Isaacson. And if you want to read more about his collection, we've got a great story from my colleague, Rachel Piper, a great photo gallery online, sltrib.com. Okay, let's move on. Our next speed dater, Mehdi Ivy Harrison. She's the author of The Bishop's Wife, a Mormon Utah mystery, and numerous YA books, including The Princess and the Hound. She's also a regular contributor to Huffington. She is, in addition, in her non-writing life, an all-American triathlete, the mother of five, and she has a PhD from Princeton University, Mehdi Ivy Harrison. 5 minutes.
Okay, I am a novelist, and in particular, I am a mystery novelist and a fantasy novelist, and that means I like plot. If you like plot, you will like this book. There are many books that are beautifully written and do not have a lot of plot. This is a book that is beautifully written and has a lot of plot. So, there's mystery in here, and what fantasy has that I love is world building and magic. And there's world building and magic in this book. The two main characters in this book are Werner Pfennig, who lives in Germany, in southern Germany. His parents are dead, and he's an orphan, and he lives with his younger sister, and they're taken in by this orphanage, and he discovers his magical power is he understands radios. He can fix the radios, and he can understand how radio waves work, and as he grows older, and the Nazis realize that he has this magical talent, they decide to use him. And he's excited at first to work for the Nazis because, for one thing, it means food, and it means that his sister will be protected. So he starts helping the Nazis track down places where people are using radios to get illegal transmissions from England and from France. And at first, he's very excited because he's very good at this, and he gets a lot of praise from his Nazi leaders. But after one particular incident where he sees a child hiding in a closet who's been shot in the head by the soldiers who have found this child after he sent them to this house, he realizes he can't do this anymore. And he refuses to help anymore, and he ends up being sent off to the front. So that's one story. The other story is about Marie Loire, who lives in Paris, and she is blind. And when the story opens, she wakes up and hears bombs falling, and she tries to find her father and realizes he is gone. He is the person that has helped her negotiate Paris, which is a huge city, for her whole life. And he is gone, and she doesn't know where he is. And everyone else that she knows has been evacuated or has left this building that she's living in. And all she has, this is her magical power, is a model of the neighborhood that she lives in wood, which her father has carved for her to help her negotiate her way through the city. And she uses that model, she takes it with her outside and makes her way through the city. Now, these two characters end up meeting each other. The world building, obviously, is World War II. If you are not fascinated by World War II, I don't know, like, I don't think we can speak. But you should know my PhD in German, from Princeton, is in Germanic languages and literatures. And if you've never studied German, you may not know that every piece of literature that's ever taught in a Germanic studies program, if it happens before World War II, it's always about how did this piece of literature lead to Hitler? Or how did this piece of literature lead to a group of people who accepted Hitler? And if it's written after, all German literature is about the aftermath of World War II. Maybe there's some that was written after I finished my program, but in the 90s when I finished, that everything was still through the lens of Hitler. So even if you're reading things that are written in the Middle Ages, you're still thinking about how did this lead to Hitler. So I am obsessed with World War II because everyone who studies Germanic literature and languages is obsessed with World War II. So that's the world building that's going on. And I told you about the magic. Let me tell you about the mystery in the story. The mystery in the story is that Marie Laure's father is a docent at a museum, and he tells her stories about a mysterious giant blue diamond, which has a curse on it. Anyone who holds this diamond dies. And she, at first, only thinks it's a story. And then she begins to realize it is not just a story. And when her father disappears, she has to figure out, has he taken the diamond with him, or has he left it somewhere for me to find? That is the mystery of the story. This is plot mystery. You cannot resist this book. Tell me you cannot resist it.
All the light we cannot see. Our final contestant in our speed dating did not get to choose her favorite book. We chose it for her, and she's a speed reader because it is this year's Pulitzer Prize winner, The Sympathizer, Catherine Weller, extraordinary person and reader. You have 5 minutes.
I am a sleeper, a spook, a spy, a man of two faces. Perhaps not surprisingly, I am also a man of two minds. I am not some misunderstood mutant from a comic book or a horror movie, although some have treated me as such. I am simply able to see any issue from both sides. So this is where I would have confessed to you that I didn't choose this book, if Jennifer hadn't outed me already. But after those initial lines in this first paragraph, I was hooked by this book. The Sympathizer is an extraordinary story, and it is one of my favorite kinds of stories, and I think it's the story that is told over and over and over again since the time of the Iliad and the Odyssey, and that is the journey. This is written in epistolatory form. It's written in the form of letters to somebody, we don't know whom, by a man who is only referred to as the commandant, who is in prison. This is basically a prison confession. As he writes his confession, we learn about how he was a young man in Vietnam before the war, and we're immediately plunged into April of 1975 and the fall of Saigon. He is drawing up a list of who gets to go in his immediate circle and the circle of the general of the army, and who gets to be left behind. He, however, is not an American sympathizer. He's a communist sleeper agent who is ordered to put himself on the list so that he can come and spy in America on the American imperialist beast. Flash forward, we're in Los Angeles. Many things happen there. It's a story of becoming, it's a story of learning, and ultimately, it's a story of being the person who is straddling the world, who is making that journey to become the person that he wants to become and perhaps can or cannot become. It is the story of the transition of America as we leave Los Angeles and go with him to the Philippines, where he acts as a consultant for a movie that is not unlike Apocalypse Now. And in fact, he's acknowledged as being very much modeled on an Apocalypse Now. So it is a book that is poetic and lovely. And because it's in epistolatory form and so well written, it's easy to breeze through. But I would encourage you to slow down and enjoy the plot points, enjoy the language, because this man, Viet Thanh Nguyen, and I did listen to how to pronounce his name, and I'm sorry I remember none of it, is a brilliant writer. This is a first novel. And that's really something to win the Pulitzer on your first novel, and I'm afraid it might be as much a curse as a blessing ultimately, but it is extraordinarily well written, especially for a first novel. And I will leave you with the last lines of the book, which I don't believe give it away, but really help cap that lovely poetry of the book. We lie in wait for the right moment and the just cause, which at this moment is simply wanting to live. And even as we write this final sentence, the sentence that will not be revised, we confess to being certain of one and only one thing. We swear to keep, on penalty of death, this one problem. Promise, we will live. Thanks.
Thank you so much. We've had master storytellers telling us stories. Have any of these books won your heart? What is at stake is this beautiful wine glass from the Salt Lake Tribune. Please vote with your applause. Lonesome Dove, Lonesome Dove. Rachel, you're the judge. March by Geraldine Brooks. A classic, a favorite, The Angle of Repose. I can't say the guy's name.
Juno Diaz, Oscar.
No, Oscar Wow.
Oscar Wow.
Wow or Whoa?
I think it's Wow.
Okay.
Wow. Oscar Wow! Many of you may not have read this yet, but what about The Sympathizer? Is it on your reading list? Did the good professor reach back into history and convince you to get a classic you've never heard of, His Family? Feel the burn. All the light we cannot see, the winner of last year's Pulitzer Prize. Rachel, who is our winner? What? That is such a journalist for you. Okay, I think it was probably Lonesome Dove, was it not? Was it not? No, who? Maybe, just maybe, they'll all get a wine glass, all right? Maybe, just maybe. All right, so that ends our speed dating section. We want to open up to questions and answers. I'm going to kick it off with one question, and then for your questions, wait for the microphone. I'll come and give it to you. My question is, does the Pulitzer Prize guarantee great storytelling? Have you ever read a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel that you didn't like? Okay. No. We'll get to you in a minute. Richard Isaacson, you were raising your hand.
I'd really rather not say, because it would maybe be somebody's favorite here. But in my own personal experience, there have been a few that I made myself finish, and I've never left one unfinished. Right now, I'm trying to get through the Executioner's Song, and that's a job. Oh. I'm halfway through it, and I'll plow through, but you have to be committed to read Executioner's Song.
I was fascinated by that one. Okay, anyone else? Catherine?
So I'm not going to out in a book, but I will say that I believe the Pulitzer, because it is an annual prize that is given for one work as opposed to a body of work, often awards a book of the time, a book that captures the zeitgeist. And it was really vibrant and wonderful at that moment. But sometimes that voice doesn't carry through. And you can see that when you look at the list of the Pulitzers. There are books there that we've all heard of, no matter how old they are. And there are books that we haven't, because they just may have been brilliant, but they are books of their time, solidly.
Becky Jo.
I was just going to say some of my favorite authors are on this list, but some of the works are sort of least well known. Willa Cather, for instance, I know is on here. And my three favorite of hers are not. So I think Catherine's point is well taken. My Antonia. Pioneers. And Death Comes from the Archbishop. Those three. Thank you.
I also think that the Pulitzer prizes are only as good as the judges, and judges' committees can be uneven. And I think there were some years as well that the Pulitzers were chosen great American novels without a lot of conflict. So I think there are some different phases through time as well.
I would just add that you'll note in 2012 there was no winner, which was outrageous. I mean, those were judges who thought there was no novel published that year that deserved a Pulitzer. I don't think so. We could have found one.
Okay, let's do some audience questions. Who has a question? Right here.
So kind of like the Oscars are more famous for this, where the runner-up, it can be more of an outrage. You know, the runner-up may be a more favorite. Personally, like the Goodfellas for me. Is there a Pulitzer Prize that, or a book that you said, wow, I can't believe it didn't win this year? Or, I mean, not this year in particularly, but maybe in the past.
Anyone? Yeah, Mehdi?
As a writer who has won very few awards, let me just tell you that spending your life holding your breath to see if you win an award is really silly. So for me, awards are things that fall from the sky that are random and may or may not have anything to do with how good a book is or isn't. I mean, all it means is that a particular jury thought that the book was wonderful, and who knows what trading and, you know, bribes went on. No, I'm kidding. But there, I don't know that they always agree unanimously on these books. I think that there's some horse trading that goes on behind the scenes, and you just, I mean, it's a lovely award, but having the idea. Sorry, I shouldn't say this right at this Pulitzer. Why did you invite me? An award is just, it is the sign of a time. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean anything beyond that. And it's a useful historical tool to look back at and see which books won in which years. But I don't necessarily think that, like, if you were a professor of American literature, would you only ever teach the Pulitzer Prize? I don't think that you would only teach those. They're not the only good books that were ever written.
Stephen.
As I look over this list, I don't know exactly which year, which finalists I might go back to and think, oh, I wish that would have won. But one author I don't see here that I think it should be here somewhere is Mark Helprin, who wrote Winter's Tale and Soldier of the Great War. And if the Pulitzer Awards Astonishing Acts of Imagination, both of those books should be on there. So I recommend those especially.
Yeah, this is a spectacular list, but looking at it, ones authors that I like that are in similar kind of multiple voice styles that I didn't notice is Barbara Kingsolver. I really enjoy her work, and I thought The Poisonwood Bible was brilliant. I don't know when it was published. I can't remember. And then also because I like different narratives, voices, and stories, I think it was wonderful that Jhumpa Lahiri's Interpreters is on there. But Sherman Alexie, I think, is also fun and fabulous, and I wonder where that would fit or belong. So,
Richard Isaacson?
One thing I notice in looking at other novels that were published in 1917, so novels that might have been competition with Ernest Poole for his family, Upton Sinclair had a novel, King Cole, Edith Wharton had a novel named Summer, Edna Ferber had a novel, Fanny herself, and Sinclair Lewis had a novel, The Job. These four people went on to win the Pulitzer in a few years after this. So the competition was pretty good that year. I don't know if they were finalists or not, but I'm merely saying that there were good authors writing then, and why Ernest Poole was chosen is anybody's guess, but these other authors had their turn and were successful.
I know some of these writers wrote also won Nobels, so I'm wondering if someone is aware of how many of them also won Nobel Prizes.
Anybody know?
I think seven did.
Seven. Okay. Just like that.
Saul Bellow was one. Toni Morrison, I think, won a Nobel.
Help me.
There were
Faulkner.
Seven, I think. Faulkner,
Hemingway.
Probably Faulkner.
He said seven.
Hemingway. I don't know if he won a Nobel or not. I have it written down someplace, but it's not with me. But
all right.
There were seven.
We'll stick with the number seven. Other questions?
There's no question at all. This is just a lie, just a fake out. I want to tell a story. I come from a pretty undistinguished Utah family. My relatives came across on the plains, but they came really, really late, only the last year before the railroad was built. So I like to say we were late to the party. But I grew up, and we were all readers, but I don't think we were really connected to any kind of literary world. So I had an 80-year-old aunt, and the whole time I was coming up and reading, she used to tell me about this famous author. And I thought, she's just name-dropping. Who is she talking about? And come to find out later, I finally put it together, is that she was the babysitter for Wallace Stegner when he... was teaching at the U.
Is this true?
It is true. My Aunt Louise, who lived in Centerville, was the babysitter for Wallace Stegner. For years, she was trying to brag to me about her connection with this great man. And it wasn't until years later, when I had fallen in love with his work, I realized that I could have asked really intimate details about what kind of diapers he used. You know what I mean? So I never got the rest of that story.
If that's not a Small Lake City story, I don't know what is. Excellent. Other questions from our audience?
Is there like a secondary award for, you know, great writers from the 30s and the 40s who were just ignored? I mean, Ralph Ellison, you had, you know, Thomas Wolfe, you had John Dos Passos. Not here. I mean, what happened?
Ask the committee.
Panelists, what happened? Catherine.
Well, I think that's where we get to what Mehdi was speaking about. It is random. What is nominated that year? Who was on that panel? It's awards that are given yearly can be uneven. And when we talk about names, like when we say Saul Bellow or John Dos Passos, at this point we're thinking about a body of work, as opposed to just singular books. And that is something that's slightly different. I mean, the Nobel is a body of work, but all of the other awards are simply one book. And I think it makes it a kind of fraught process, and one that we could just second guess all night long, really. It's a valuable thing, and it's wonderful to see people thinking and talking about reading so much, but I don't know if we can say who from the 60s on that list is really going to be around that we'll be talking about and say, what happened in the 60s in 20, 30 years either. Maddie.
All right, this is answering the question in sort of a roundabout way, but one of the things I have asked myself periodically is Shakespeare really the greatest living writer in the history of the English language, or is he the writer that someone decided on at some point was a really great writer and people started quoting him and it snowballed so that now there's so many Shakespeareisms in our language and people are used to going to him for profound thoughts that he sort of becomes the greatest writer because everybody now who writes has references to Shakespeare, and it almost becomes less about whether he actually is the greatest living writer, he's not living, obviously, but he lives in the spirit of writing, but he's a writer that now everybody has to know in order to continue to write in the language, and it was interesting in studying German literature that Shakespeare also has a place there. I mean, he's been translated in so many different languages. It's interesting to see people who quote Shakespeare in other languages. But again, I don't know if it's because he's really the greatest writer or if it's just because people are used to quoting him and it's so familiar that that's what happens. And I think that there's this also effect with the Pulitzer and with other prizes, the Newbery in the young adult world. That you get people who read the list of the books and they start to think those are the greatest books, and unless they do a little bit more work behind the scenes as you have done, then they may not know what other books are written that year, what the other authors out there that are wonderful. It concerns me sometimes about giving too much credence to these awards. There are many wonderful writers who, for weird reasons, just don't win awards.
Can I add one thing? Moby Dick. You guys have heard of Moby Dick? Herman Melville published that book, and it ruined his career. It tanked. Just awful book. No one liked it. It's not an awful book. Well, I like it. But 1850, published that book. No one liked it. 1920s or thereabouts, rediscovered. He's long gone, died in poverty. Rediscovered 1920s, and Moby Dick's a classic, right? Everybody at least knows the plot of Moby Dick, if not all the chapters on cetology. It's a great book, by the way, that's all.
I was just going to put in a plug for other ways to find books. I mean, there are a lot of wonderful books on this list, but in some ways, awards really are kind of random, as Catherine was saying. And each year depends on those judges. And what we all need to do is wander into our local independent bookstores and ask the booksellers what to read, right?
Very good. Question in the back here.
My question to the panel is this. So many of the books on the list are, a lot of times it's the last book that the author published. Hemingway, and a lot of them, some even after the author actually passed away, Confederacy of Dunces and a few others. So my question is, maybe in some cases the panel decided that if great art, in some cases perhaps, they overlooked great books in the past for whatever reason, that maybe they thought that maybe some of the authors actually deserved that award, even though it was at the end of their lives. Just a question. I'm just curious to your response to that.
Thank you so much. Richard.
Yeah. One example that's kind of interesting is Kenneth Roberts, who wrote many historical fictions and didn't ever get a traditional Pulitzer Award for that. But in 1958, he was given a special Pulitzer Award for his body of work, and that was the Pulitzer given that year. He wrote a book called Arundel and one Northwest Passage. Those two have probably been the most famous, but interesting. I don't know if it was posthumous for him, but in 58, he was the winner of the Pulitzer for a body of work.
I'm going to take the moderator's privilege and ask the final question. Something you said, Richard, struck me. You said that you read this book again for this event. I'm wondering if the selections that you made, if you read the book
a second time and why you did that. What's the advantage of reading a book a second time?
Oh, I'll
Becky
answer,
Jo.
And then there's several books I read and reread. March is one of those. I've taught it a couple times to an introduction to fiction class. And to me, that's what makes a good book, is the one that I read and reread. And every time I go back, you said something earlier about reading a book after you've had children. Those kinds of life events change the way we read. So every time I've gone back to Great Gatsby, for instance, new things emerge. It's just a whole new experience. And to say you've read a book once and put it back on the shelf, it must not have been a very good book, is my attitude.
Stephen.
I did go back to Lonesome Dove. I confess I did not read every one of the pages in Lonesome Dove in the last week, all 945 of them. But when I picked it up, I wanted to see if Gus McRae still resonated with me the way he had 30 years ago. And he absolutely did. I just started smiling when I started reading the book. And I think it's really good to go back to books that we read earlier in our lives and see if they still sound the same, very much reflecting these comments. Helen MacDonald's new book, H is for Hawk, for instance, makes me want to go back and read T.H. White's The Once and Future King, which meant a lot to me when I was young. And I plan to do that next.
Yes, Erica.
I also had the best of intentions to read my book again, like Stephen, and started to, didn't get through all of it. It's exam week at the university. But I did enjoy it just as much. I saw new things that inspired me to friend the author on Facebook, so I've done that. And learn more about the author, who actually has several other works and is also a teacher and is doing some really interesting, important, and amazing things. So rereading the book made me want to know more about the writer, more about the body of work, and I did appreciate it just as much as I did the first time around.
And
so
I'm not trying to put anyone on the spot. Right. What's the value in rereading?
I think the value of rereading, there hasn't been that many years between my first read and now, but yeah, coming to it with new eyes every time you read a text, I think, is the value in it. So it's been wonderful.
Maddie?
When my children were in elementary school, there was a program that the teachers used called AR, which I despise and hate and have written essays on why I don't like it. But one of the problems I had with it was that my children were never given any credit for rereading books. They only got credit for reading it the first time through. And the tests were very much about plot-oriented things. And I love plot, but that's not the only reason that books exist. And I feel like as a child, I sometimes read and reread books and that I learned things about storytelling. I learned things about how you get to know a character, how to do a really good description that also moves the plot forward. There are a lot of lessons that you're not ready for all the first time around, so you get to learn them again. And this last year, one of my bookshelves collapsed in the middle of the day. Just suddenly there was this thunderous sound, and I went upstairs and saw all of the books from this bookshelf collapsed on the floor. And I realized that it was time for me to do one of those cullings of books. And I ended up looking through all of my library of thousands of books in my house, and I did this painful thing where I decided I was only keeping books that I wanted to read again. For a long time, I had this vision in my head that I was going to be the cool grandma who the grandkids would come over to my house and they'd find all the cool books. And my kids rolled their eyes. They're all teenagers and older now. And they're like, Mom, nobody's going to be reading physical copies of books. So our children are not going to be coming to your house and you're not going to be cool for that reason. So I gave up the idea that I was keeping books for my kids and started, I made this collection of books that I was getting rid of. It was very painful, and I actually found myself as I was taking the books out thinking, oh no, that one book I can't give away quite yet. And a friend of mine had been reading a book about decluttering. I will say this one last thing for those of you who are true book lovers. And she said this book on decluttering suggested that if you truly love certain books, you should just rip out your favorite pages and paste them together and put those on your bookshelf. And she looked at, when she told this to me, I was like, what? No, how could you do such a thing? And I realized how important it is to have every page of a book. That's not the way that we read. We don't just pull out our favorite pages and only read those again. You read the whole book again.
For those in our radio audience, there's like, people in the audience just got a sucker punch when she said, extract one page. Ellen.
One of the readers who volunteered their opinions about books that I quoted in the Salt Lake Tribune talked about how she could tell a good book because the feeling of the book lasted with her, even if the details of the plot had fallen away. And I thought that was a really beautiful way to talk about what reading can be.
Thank you, Speed Day. Oh, Richard, please.
I was just going to say that these books feel like my friends. And some I like better than others, but as friends, but we do. They become our friends. And I thought, would you tear part of your friend up? And just horrible thought. But I like coming back to them like I do coming to old friends. And reliving some of those, and now that I've read all of them, I can go back and start reading them a second time and revisit these old friends. But that's the beauty of it. The feeling of it is there, and you welcome the chance to read Angle of Repose again, or To Kill a Mockingbird, or whatever your best friend is. Go read it again, and you'll have a little different perspective on it over time.
Speed Daters, thank you for sharing your expertise, your passion. I love it.